I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 2019, and I say 2019, it's not even out yet. The album, the soundtrack to Bathtubs Over Broadway, the artist, various, but compiled by Mr. Steve Young, who is my guest today. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Hey, Jason, my pleasure.
So I saw the documentary on recommendation from, if I'm not mistaken, the archivist for Firesign Theater, and he said I should check it out. He was absolutely right that I was in love with it. But you and I have been emailing, and I did say that I'm happy somebody else is obsessed with this. Otherwise, it would probably be something I would get obsessed with.
Yes, I'm happy to take on the mantle of, okay, you all can relax. I'll take this little corner of human oddity. And there's plenty for everybody, but I will try to hold down the fort on the world of corporate musicals.
It's insane to me that they exist. I knew something of them. I had bought an IBM album that, but it has no music, no original music that I can tell. It's just a very long play. And the documentary is wonderful. I recommend people watch it. But maybe you can kind of give a little miniature retelling here of how you discovered this stuff and why it stuck with you.
Sure. So I was a writer for David Letterman for 25 years. I started in 1990 when the show was at NBC, kept going over to the CBS era. When I got to the show, I was tasked with running a segment. It had been going for a number of years already, called Dave's Record Collection.
Yeah,
and I'm sure many of your vinyl fans out there would recall this. Unintentionally weird and funny record albums that the staff would gather, and Dave would hold up on the show and explain what it was, and we'd hear a little sample. He would have a joke. In the early years, it came out organically from Dave Letterman and some of the original staffers saying, you know, I got this Robert Mitchum Sings Calypso. Oh, yeah, I've got Sebastian Cabot Lodge reading the lyrics of Bob Dylan. Just these oddities that they realize, you know, if we get three or four or five of these funny records together, we could have a bit on the show. And that was delightful and successful for a number of years. They kind of ran through a lot of the low-hanging fruit, like William Shatner singing and Leonard Nimoy singing.
Sure.
By the time I got to the show in 1990, that low-hanging fruit had largely been picked over. I would go out to thrift shops and record stores around New York City looking for something we could squeeze a joke out of. And by that point, it was a lot of learn to touch type and teach your parakeet to talk and stuff that was very weird, out of context when you take 20 seconds of it. Could be wonderful. I started coming back with these souvenir record albums from company conventions and sales meetings. And it was a very slow trickle at first. I just thought, well, this is just a one-off.
Of course.
A General Electric musical about the power industry. Or here's a musical about selling insurance at an insurance company's sales meeting. And I thought, thank God for this stuff. This is just what we need now that we've run out of the celebrities. Because this stuff is high octane craziness. I couldn't believe it was real. And by the time I had, I don't know, four or five of them, I realized, number one, apparently it's a genre because I keep finding them.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but they are apparently out there. And number two, I realized I think a lot of this stuff is actually fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be. Number one, there shouldn't be a musical about selling and servicing diesel engines. But if there is, it shouldn't be this good. What the hell is going on here? Who are the people that made this? Why did they do it? What did they think about what they were doing? What else did they do? And that kicked me into a new phase of tracking down people whose names I would find on these credits and the record albums. And the movie, Bathtubs Over Broadway, which is now on Netflix and iTunes and Amazon and all the rest, traces my journey from this initial sort of casual skepticism and cynicism about, oh, how awful and pathetic that there's a musical about selling tractors, down to the curiosity and why is this stuff sticking with me? What's the story? What was this world? To me, finding the people who were absolutely certain that no one was ever going to know about this or ask them about it. People now in their 70s, 80s, 90s, stunned that someone was coming to their door or calling them on the phone to ask questions about this, to the point where I've left Dave's record collection way behind in this. And these people are my friends and my mentors often, and even collaborators and people I value deeply. And just from the wildly unlikely beginning, something that actually changed my life. And so the movie is about that, and it is deeply surreal and hilarious. And then under the direction of Deva Wisenant, she crafted a story that is so powerful in a humanity and full of heart way that people go into this movie thinking, oh, it'll be kitschy and cute and superficial, and they come out wiping tears off their cheeks thinking, what the hell was that? How did you make me actually sob about this by the end? So I'm thrilled to be involved with this. And then now we have the soundtrack album. It's 32 cuts, mostly the vintage corporate musical show tunes that we were never supposed to hear. And we're going to have a vinyl double record set later this year that we're now working on the details of. These were all songs that Deva, the director, chose at certain moments in the movie. I have an archive of thousands of them, but this was all her artistry to select the music as part of the story of the movie. And I'll just say that these records are shockingly rare. They were only tiny runs, private pressings for people within the company. You and I were never supposed to know that these shows had happened. Mm-hmm. They were all marked private use only, not for broadcast, not for airplay. I have quite a number of records in my collection that are the single known copy of a show.
Wow.
It was like sometimes, okay, 200 guys came to the cafeteria steam table company convention, and you see the picture of 217 of them out on the lawn of the convention center, and you think that's probably pretty close to how many records were pressed.
Right.
So if one survived, what a miracle.
I mean, that, of course, is the rarity of it is exciting.
Yeah, everybody thinks, oh, Skip James and Devil Got My Woman or Robert Johnson, all these like blues records from the 30s that are super fetishized and like collectors are drooling over, oh, another copy turned up somewhere in West Virginia and it's going to go for six figures. And the stuff that I'm dealing with and just a handful of other collectors who are really into it, absolutely the equal of this early blues stuff in terms of rarity. You can argue aesthetically whether or not you care about it, but I will tell you, and I think the movie makes an excellent case for it, it needs to be given some serious consideration. There were A-list Broadway people working on these shows because Ford and General Electric and all these other giant companies, money was not an issue. Hiring the best talent, performers, directors, choreographers, writers. There's some stuff in there, and this was what got me early on, just like, why can I not get these songs about selling diesel engines out of my head? What sort of dark magic has been applied to this project? This should not be this good. So turns out these shows are shot full of people who the Broadway world is absolutely very familiar with. The very first one I ever found, it was a General Electric Utility Executive Conference show. John Kander and Fred Ebb.
Wow. Well,
they wrote Chicago. They wrote Cabaret. Another writer on that show, Walter Marks, who I've become friends with, had a couple of big Broadway shows. He wrote I Gotta Be Me. I mean, these people are the real deal, and they were very happy to take these corporate gigs. They paid wonderfully, but you got to work on your craft. And if you could write a great song about selling insurance or being a Coca-Cola bottler or the 180 uses of silicone products, if you could pull it off, nothing was ever going to intimidate you again creatively, I would have to say.
That's the kind of that's the most amazing part to me, is that I think maybe the initial cynicism of something like that is like, oh, this is so incredibly corporate, it's about the dumbest thing, until, as you say, you discover and remember, oh, there are all these people behind it.
Yeah, wonderful people actually who could not bear to do anything less than their best work. And that was thrilling to me when I started interviewing these people. Anybody who has to try to figure out every day how to be inspired, and I was going to the Letterman show every day for 25 years, what are my ideas for today? What are my bits? What are my jokes? Probably none of them will last or even get picked. To be able to say, I am going to continue to do my best work every time because that is my only setting, that was very inspiring to hear from people.
I want to continue, but the damn the trash truck is outside. Of course it is. So give me a moment.
True. I'm trying to think if I have any musicals about trash trucks.
You must.
We did a corporate event with the movie at a company called Federal Signal, and they make dump truck bodies. So that's pretty close.
Oh my goodness! I'm assuming you're an encyclopedia of this stuff at this point.
Sadly or gloriously, yes. Mm-hmm. There are only a few people in the world who I would say collect this stuff on a serious level, and I'm pretty well up there in knowing the details. Although it was interesting, as the movie was in production over the course of 4 years, Deva, the director, who knew nothing about this until she learned about my collecting and the book that came out, she immersed herself in it to the point where she knew more about some of it than I did. And that kind of freaked me out. Like, I thought I was the guy. I forgot that detail. Oh my God, I guess I'm not the guy anymore. But that was also wonderful, because it meant other people saw something in this, like what I saw, and cared enough about it to bring the story out of the shadows into the light.
Well, people don't often talk about that part of documentary filmmaking. I made a documentary a few years ago, and to be honest, I started out, and it's hard, I can't relay this because I don't star in my documentary, but it started out more cynical than anything anybody might have assumed you were approaching your love of this stuff with. I started out a documentary where about a sport that I wanted to make fun of, until I got about, I don't know, 5 interviews in, and I realized, A, that's shitty, and B, oh, these people are fascinating, and I'm kind of interested in this sport, even though it started out as a prank. And you inevitably get sucked into the human side, if you're a person, I think. You get sucked into the human side of this stuff.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's the template, and I did not really know much about filmmaking or documentaries until I was in the midst of one, and I've developed an enthralled appreciation for how this is done at the highest levels, where you take what seems like an unlikely, trivial beginning of some tiny backwater of human endeavor, and from the tiny, unlikely seed, you sprout the magnificent tree of all human drama and intrigue and emotion and highs and lows and comedy and tragedy. The best filmmakers take the tiny beginning and show us the full range of human experience out of it. And I will make the claim that that's what Deva Wisenant has done with Bathtubs Over Broadway. But you don't have to care about Broadway to find this world enthralling. A lot of comedy enthusiasts find that, well, it's this backstage glimpse of the Letterman show that made it very intriguing for them. We were the only project ever allowed to shoot backstage and in the offices of the Letterman show during the final weeks and months of its existence. Uh-huh. So that's a wonderful document all by itself. I'm thrilled that Dave Letterman believed in the project and wanted to be associated with it to the point where his name is on it as an executive producer. But it's eerie now for my Letterman colleagues to watch this movie and see this world brought back to life. It's like glorious HD footage of your deceased grandparents from years ago that you didn't know had been shot. To see right. that on the screen again, just, oh my God, it's all back.
Yeah, that I can't imagine. That, to be fair, yes, as a comedy lover and as a person who grew up watching Letterman probably more than anything early on, I don't know why my mother was letting me stay up and watch it. That was huge for me. I don't think I even knew that. I don't think I knew that about, because I don't think I knew that you were the main subject of it. I just knew the subject matter. And then to find out, oh, wow, there's this Letterman connection, there's this and that. And I don't know. It's a dense movie, and one of the many reasons I think people should watch it, besides listening to the great music, is definitely for your story and for the, just honestly, my favorite part is you relating to these people who you become friends with. That is a very genuinely beautiful part of the movie. It's just these friendships, and I'm not going to give anything away. People should watch it, because at the very end, there's some stuff about your friendships with these people that will touch you. And if it doesn't, maybe you don't have a heart. It's pretty delightful.
People don't expect that. Like I was saying, people, even friends of mine who knew that I'd been collecting this stuff for years and had been involved in something, and there was some sort of documentary afoot, I think they thought it was going to be a sort of dry, academic, maybe tongue-in-cheek, but still rather just informational, panning across a picture like a Ken Burns documentary. And then this happened this year, and corporate America was gaining strength. And meanwhile, General Electric was putting together a new program for its salesmen. And people thought they would go into it and sort of nod politely and chuckle a couple of times. And then it turns out that it is this hidden history that you didn't know about, this unbelievable music and film clips. We have films of this corporate show business material that no one had ever seen before. And then just the final thing that wallops you is this very affecting human story, because no, really, people don't see that coming. I didn't see that coming when we were starting with any of this. I could not have imagined where this goes. And this is the thrilling potential of documentaries. You get into it thinking that it's going to be this, and then it shifts out from under you and you realize you got a much bigger tiger by the tail than you thought.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if it were a movie about records, just about records, it would not be the same thing, obviously. It's a perfect seed for all of this. I really want to talk about, so I had asked you to pick a few tracks from it, because I've obviously seen the film, but pick a few things from it that you think might illustrate the most self-aware comedy, like, these people are clearly, they know what they're doing. That's the big thing. They knew what they were writing. None of these people were unaware that writing a song about silicone is ridiculous. But they put their hearts into it.
I mean, you had to walk a line with this stuff.
Yes.
Some of it now seems weirdly obtuse. Like, it was just rah-rah cheerleading unironically. Uh-huh. But the better versions of this stuff, the writers went out and talked to people at these companies and said, what is really bothering you that the management doesn't understand? These shows could be a way for management consulting, in a way, just like, what is wrong in this company that no one dares talk about? Let's talk about it in a song that's going to be this safe psychological buffer zone of it's fun and it's funny, but suddenly we'll have all had this cathartic moment. There are a few songs like that. I don't know if any of them are in the movie, but the Silicones show that you mentioned, it's a General Electric show from 1973, got to investigate silicones. The team that wrote that, Hank Beebe and Bill Heyer, I think were kind of the Lennon and McCartney of industrial shows. And people, when I say that, often chuckle. But I also point out, I don't think John Lennon and Paul McCartney could have handled these assignments. They were geniuses in a certain way, but you had to have a certain weird range of talents to pull off this corporate stuff that not that many people had. But Hank and Bill wrote a lot of my favorites, Diesel Dazzle being one of them, the Detroit Diesel Engine show. I just love it. There's a show called Diesel Dazzle.
Brilliant.
And it's great. It's way too good. But the Silicones show, I have a film from that, and the films of any of this stuff is a degree of magnitude rarer than any of the records. I'm thrilled to have some of these films, but you see this film and you realize these guys knew that this was crazy to do this, but they said, if we're going to do it, let's just do it and make it really great and have fun with it. So the humor in that one actually kind of stands up. Some of the humor of this stuff, you're laughing at it. The better stuff, you're still laughing with, remarkably, 50 years later, out of context. So, yeah, there's the Silicones album has a couple great songs on it, one of which is in the soundtrack album, Silicones. If you want to play a clip from that, be my guest.
Just a touch of silicones, silicones. They can wash your product's problems away. They're very good at saving the day. You'll see a million ways it can pay.
I would say another unavoidable one. It's a huge part of the movie. The American Standard bathroom fixture musical from 1969 called The Bathrooms Are Coming, which was staged in Las Vegas and Atlanta for a plumbing fixture distributors conference. And American Standard's like touting all its great new line of shower stalls and tubs and sinks and toilets and faucets that you are going to have a great year selling. And this is a huge part of the movie. I meet a lot of the personnel from this show nearly 50 years later and really get into it deeply with them. But the song My Bathroom is this sort of ode to the woman's special refuge in her house. And it is an eerily jewel-like, beautiful song that musically I think is absolutely legitimate. And then it's about this crazy subject matter. I call it the gateway drug of industrial musicals because people can't believe that it's real and it's done sincerely. But there is a certain layer of humor to it, but it's a humor that was not really for us. We're looking at it as outsiders, and it's hard to judge just how to even think about, is this real or legitimate or not? But the vocalist is marvelous, a woman I'm friends with named Pat. You can't avoid My Bathroom. If you're going to play a clip, I would encourage that to be one because it's makes people go, oh, so that's what we're talking about. Okay.
My bathroom is a private kind of place. Very special kind of place. The only place where I can stay, making faces at my face. My bathroom is my very special room, where I primp and fuss and groom, where I can get away from all and really feel in bloom. I'm free.
Can really be me.
There's a moment in the movie, if I'm not mistaken, where there's an audience watching along, and I do believe some of them sound incredibly familiar with it. There's this Rocky Horror vibe to what's going on. And I feel like that happened a couple times where maybe people at that point knew what to expect. Did that happen along the way?
Not to give too away too much about the movie, but at one point I go out and do a show where I come to a city with like a 90-minute show of vintage films and film clips from this stuff. And in one instance, I had shown the film of The Bathrooms Are Coming, and people were now suddenly very aware that this was a thing. And then I brought up one of the original cast members on stage, and we did a song live, and people who could not have imagined caring about this 3 hours earlier were now just gripping the armrests of their chairs, white knuckled with astonishment that all this was happening right in front of them. It was a weirdly powerful moment.
I mean, that's such a huge part of it, is that you have discovered this thing that, for regardless of your level of or type of appreciation of, there's so much artistry and effort went into it that of course you're going to get sucked in. You sent me 5 or 6 tracks where I'm like, these are all so good and I want to keep listening to every single one of them, number one. And then number two, I don't know if this one's in the film or not. I apologize for not remembering because it's been a few months since I watched it first, but my favorite line of anything on anything that you sent me was, I love my hysterectomy, and that made me almost fall over.
I really enjoyed my appendectomy.
And I loved my hysterectomy.
Love
those drapes, those towels, and those caps.
By converters,
I feel good and clean in them. I don't mind being seen in them.
Love new disposable way.
If the patient starts moaning and groaning,
that won't bother me.
If she gets a transfusion, a contusion,
I'll still be comfy as can be.
We never enjoyed our operation, so every complication, so we've had such a ball of it.
August.
Next year.
I could use another scar on the right side.
Next year.
It's going to match up with the one on the left.
Right here.
Yeah, that's the same guy who wrote The Bathrooms Are Coming.
Okay.
Quite a wonderful and weirdly talented man who I had the pleasure to know for a little while. Yeah, that was from the American Hospital Supply show of 1967, all about the new line of disposable paper gowns and surgical sheets and things like that. Just what is the least promising topic for a musical that you can imagine? Well, you've got a lot of candidates in this genre, but the disposable paper hospital supplies is definitely right up there. And yeah, that song is in the movie. You hear a little bit about, I really enjoyed my appendectomy. I loved my hysterectomy, thanks to all these disposable paper, whatever. I've had people, after the soundtrack was released and they downloaded it and they were driving around listening to it, and they come to that bit about the hysterectomy line, a guy wrote to me and said, I had to struggle not to do a spit take of soda onto my car's windshield driving through Wisconsin listening to that. But yeah, there is surprising opportunities for strange wit and comedy in these things. I mean, the rhymes, the book that came out several years ago, which I co-authored, has a page of the Industrial Musical Rhyme Hall of Fame. The arcane topics meant that you got to have rhyming challenges and opportunities that you don't get in any other kind of songwriting. Like when you just think about how often do you get to rhyme compressor or invoice or something. It's just, it's when you get one, I mean, these guys and occasionally women writing them must have just like at 2 a.m. just going, oh my God, look what I just did. And I can't really tell anybody because no one cares and no one knows what I'm doing. But 50 years later, I care. So yeah, the hospital supply song is pretty fun. That's in the soundtrack. That was a live recording. And we restaged that song with choreography and costumes and real singers and dancers at the movie's world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival a year and a half ago.
Wow.
The audience, who, as I say, 3 hours earlier could not have imagined caring or believing that any of this was real or significant, was now seeing a song from this show revived 50 years later and was just hollering with astonished glee that any of this could actually be happening.
Yeah, there's this absurd beauty to it that I don't know. If nothing else came from it, the idea that you have opened up this window to appreciate all these artists is wonderful, because these are people who, while, as you say, many of them accomplished otherwise, it's kind of great to have. I don't know, some people don't like having their early stuff or their rare stuff dug up, but these people seem to genuinely appreciate that you found and gave a shit and weren't making fun of them.
Yeah, it's been wonderful for a lot of these older writers and performers and their families, who said for decades it was pretty much impossible to explain to anybody what I did or what Dad had done. Because you'd start saying, well, there used to be these sales meetings where there would be a musical portion or an entire like Broadway show sort of, and people would just sort of lose interest, or saying, oh, so it's like commercials. Well, no. Well, yes, but no, not really, because the public could never hear this. This was all to motivate the salesman, and people just thought this is too outlandish to be believed. And anyway, I can't imagine it really, so I'm just going to stop listening. And these people who did this and their families, just the relief that finally the weird little burden of being unable to explain a career or a large part of a career, now you can point to this movie and say, this tells the story so powerfully and elegantly and entertainingly that they get to relax a little bit. And one of my friends, who's in his 90s now, who I've become quite close to, and we've collaborated on things, he wrote me an email after the soundtrack came out, and some of his earlier work is in the soundtrack, and he said, you have done a wonderful thing, you and Deva and all the people on this project. For so many years in New York and the New York theater scene, I was looked down on. People knew I did these industrial shows. Prominent people in the Broadway world would call me the king of the industrial shows, and they meant it as an insult. Ugh. All those people are dead. I am still alive, and I now see people who were not even born when this stuff was happening watching this movie with delight and surprise and wonderment, and listening to the songs, honestly listening to them to see, are these great songs? Can we actually, yes, we can enjoy these songs because they're good songs. What a wonderful vindication for people who never thought that any of this would come out.
Well, that's the hardest thing in the world, too. So we talk a lot. Well, okay, I talk because I'm obsessed with it. I talk a lot about people's legacy. I think at some point you always get concerned with your own. It's not often that an opportunity comes about for somebody to rewrite or even expose the true nature of your legacy. It's nice that exists for them, because there's nothing wrong with giving an artist some new perspective on it, too. I will bet there are some people who maybe had written it off and like, I don't know what to make of this anymore. Enough people crap on it. You might just be like, well, maybe I was a big sellout, or I was this or that. It's kind of nice to be redeemed in a way where it's like, no, I'm an artist too, and I can genuinely appreciate where you're coming from.
Yeah, I mean, it is a weird conundrum to think, if you are a creative person or writer, composer, and the best work that you ever did in a long and varied career, somehow maybe the purely best thing you ever wrote was for a floor tile company. How do you even grapple with how to feel about that.
Yeah.
And people kind of gave up on, well, I know this was great, but I can't really explain it to the outside world, so I guess I'll just not worry about it. And people would tell me, I dug out those record albums after we talked and I played them for the first time in 45 years. And that stuff was good, wasn't it? Yeah.
Right.
I mean, all these people had to do it and move past and do the next one and hurry to the next project. When you were successful at this, you were always working and you never really had time to think about what was that show really like and how good was it? And now years later, they're revisiting it. So I'm just feeling very lucky that I blundered into something that could open up this world in a way that brought some vindication and satisfaction to some great people. And thank God Dava Wisenant decided that she wanted to make this movie, because I mean, the book was wonderful. I would have been satisfied if it had just been the book, but the movie is just so much a leap to another level that really galvanizes people.
Yeah, it's delightful. I will repeat again, it's worth watching. I reached out to Steve because I love the movie. It wasn't the other way around. This is not a PR thing. However, I am going to promote the heck out of that album when it comes out on vinyl for sure. You know, you're making me think too. I mean, some of our most famous painters, at least from certain periods, made all their money making paintings of kings and queens, and that's the same. It's the same damn thing, and they're still beautiful, and they're still hanging in museums. It's the same situation.
People who now reflexively want to sneer at any sort of art that falls under the rubric of commerce. I mean, this is a can get to be a very deep conversation. I'm not an expert. I'm not a historian or art historian by training. I'm a comedy writer, but I tell people, you know, Michelangelo didn't paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling for fun.
Right.
The largest corporation in the world hired him to do a gig to convey a message that the organization wanted to convey. This is not a new phenomenon that people are hired by organizations to turn their art toward this kind of purpose. So the modern iterations of it may seem bizarre, partly because they were so well hidden from the public. Yes, everybody was supposed to look at the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Nobody outside the Ford tractor dealer organization was supposed to know about the Ford tractor musical. So there is that weird element to it, but the underlying impulse is not that different.
Do you know about how far in terms of albums or in terms of years, how far into that collection you started to realize that it was something more than what it was, than it was just, hey, these are some more of Dave's weird records? Do you know how far in it was?
The first one I found was 1993. By 1995 or 6, I was actively starting to look for them and thinking, well, I don't care if this gets on the show or not. I just want more of these. And it was in 1996 that I first started trying to do some halting amateurish research on who were the people who made these things and can I find them. And I started filling up notebooks with notes on phone calls and interviews I had with people.
Did you record any of these interviews or phone calls?
Later.
Okay.
The book that I co-authored with my friend Sport Murphy, who's a very wonderfully smart and funny writer and collector and aficionado, that was around 2011, 2012 that we were working on that. And I went back and did interviews with people I'd previously spoken to, but I said, now I would like to make recordings of these, take it a little more seriously. And so I have a quite large and still growing trove of an archive of audio interviews with people.
That's wonderful. Do you ever, well, I'm sure you do, I know you do sometimes, but are all your albums digitized or is that too mammoth of an idea?
Well, yes. during the course of doing the documentary, sometimes Dava would say, now in this interview we had with so-and-so, he mentioned this particular song. But I don't have that song. What's the deal with that? And I would say, oh, yeah, I mean, I have that song. I think that's one I didn't dub off my records, though. And she said, you mean there's stuff that you have that I don't have yet? So I said, I've got, what, I don't know, 200-something records. Maybe each one has 10 songs, let's say, and I've picked my three favorites to dub off. So 70% of my collection, yeah, you don't have. And she said, well, that's got to change. And so I started the long process of going back to every single record and methodically making sure every track was transferred. And that was a wonderful thing to do, because sometimes I listened to a record once or twice in 1998 and sort of said, I like this, this, and this. And then 20 years later, I'm saying, oh my God, I've completely forgotten about this other song. My tastes have changed, I guess, because now I think this one is the winner and I'd forgotten. Okay, and I emailed Deva, oh my God, I just found something wonderful. And some of those late rediscovered songs are actually in the movie as well. So I was very glad to have had that chore, because it was the right thing to do. I wanted all this stuff properly organized anyway, but it did help the film as well.
Yeah. Is there, I'm curious now, boy, you're helping expose people's legacies, probably helping build their legacies for them. I'm wondering, has it changed your own perception of your legacy and your work? Because, you know, I've been doing some archive work and seeing just the sheer number of monologue jokes people write, or sketch jokes, or whatever the hell they write for late night shows. The number, just the sheer number, and the few that actually make it out there, is like, that is fairly thankless. And so I'm just wondering if it's given you a different perspective on having written as much as you did.
Yeah, I think about that occasionally. Like when I'm 88 years old, will someone come to me and say, we've discovered a forgotten part of your own career that we would like to talk about? It's possible, but everything that I wrote for the Letterman show, well, it was for a show that was supposed to be seen by the public. It was not really a secretive behind the closed doors thing, although maybe 98% of the material wasn't used. I would be surprised if there was anything on the scope or scale of what the industrial shows turned out to be that could be discovered about my life, but I'm not going to worry about that. I'm very happy that I was the right person at the right place and time to help bring this to light, along with Deva and her team who made the movie. I would say I'm gonna try not to worry about my legacy. I hope I have a few decades left. Maybe I've still got some surprises up my sleeve, and maybe years from now, if there's an obituary written about me, it would be interesting. Is the Letterman show just going to be a one-line aside footnote to some bigger story? I don't know whether that's possible, but I would like to think I'm not sure how this all shakes out in terms of what, if anything, I've done.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that, I just think, at least in terms of my own perspective lately, I've been reconsidering every person I'm interested in terms of, oh, I know so very little about, I know this one thing, like, I'm obsessed with the show News Radio, and I've interviewed Paul Simms, but I don't know that I've ever interviewed him much about his other work, probably not, and there's probably some stuff in there that maybe he wants to talk about, maybe he doesn't. But that's the one thing that's going to stick out for me, is the thing that meant the most to me. But now I kind of want to dig even more. And I think movies like this and your book and the fact that you're interested in it is one of those things that might help people realize, oh, there's more to it than we're seeing on the surface. And not just more to it, but there's so much brilliant stuff sitting in there. Are there albums that, like entire albums, you would recommend that people seek out if they're going to start getting interested in this?
But to your point about you know a little bit about a person and you peg them as this person known for that. And
yeah.
Then it turns out, well, that's 5% of what they did. Like everybody wanted to talk to Florence Henderson about the Brady Bunch.
Sure.
And she graciously, over many years, I think, put up with that and interviewed did interviews and answered questions, but she was much less often asked about doing the Oldsmobile dealer announcement shows, which she did for a number of years before the world of the Brady Bunch, when she was a very legitimate and accomplished Broadway performer, and she would do these musicals for the Oldsmobile dealer force, introducing the new models every fall. And she said, I'm very proud of those shows. I would put those shows up against anything that was on Broadway. And I think she was just happy, along with other people like Cheetah Rivera and Martin Short, who are also in the movie talking about their industrial show work, that somebody cared to find out what this chapter meant to them and how valuable it was to their burgeoning careers and all that. So, yes, there, everybody contains multitudes. And if you know the few sort of shorthand facts about somebody, that's great, but there's probably a lot more there. Yeah, you can go on eBay or Discogs and try to track down some of these records that are actually beautifully produced and weirdly entertaining to my mind. I mean, I'm always going to recommend Diesel Dazzle and The Bathrooms Are Coming, and if you can find a copy of The Bathrooms Are Coming now for less than six figures, boy, you're doing really well. I remember I used to be able to buy them for $5 or $10. Those days are over.
Wow. That's crazy to me. I mean, I guess I'm not surprised, but I mean, this is going, I'm sure the movie, and I'm sure your own obsession is going to now. I mean, it doesn't, it kind of screws up your own collection a little bit, doesn't it? Just a little.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the really arcane ones where only myself and two other people in the world even know that it exists, mm-hmm. that I might still be able to find for $5 if in 20 years a copy floats to the surface. But the marquee items like The Bathrooms Are Coming, the market value on all this stuff is still sort of nebulous and shaky, but there are a few ones now that are notorious and that people will seek out and bid up to pretty hefty prices. But I did, during the quiet years, put aside a lot of good duplicates. So maybe that's my 401k program.
There you go. Pardon me. Oh, geez. Oh, my goodness. I wanted to maybe dig in just a little bit. I'm not going to keep you forever, but I want to dig in a little bit. I believe you told me originally you didn't really listen to a lot of comedy growing up.
Yeah, I feel a bit like I must be an outlier to some degree, because I know a lot of the people you interview are really deeply into collecting and listening to comedy, and I had not very much of that growing up. Like, I don't think I owned any comedy albums. I did have a few odds and ends. Like, I had some Mad Magazine paperback compilations, but they were all stuff from like before I was born.
Uh-huh.
And it was like stuff from 1957 to 63, and I'm reading this stuff in the mid-70s going, who the hell is Estes Kefauver? but I didn't care that I didn't know, because I got it at some primal level that this was some sort of weird, snarky, gleeful something. So I liked that, even if I didn't get all the references. And I had a set of Woody Allen essays and short stories.
Sure, yeah.
I think my parents, recognizing there's some weird glimmer of humor in this kid, but we don't know what to do exactly. Well, let's give him some of these Woody Allen books. And again, they were full of references that I didn't know. Like, he's in the New York Jewish world, and I most definitely was not, and I didn't. Like, there was something called No Kaddish for Weinstein. And I thought, what's Kaddish? It must be like a pastry. No. So I you blunder your way through on this stuff. But I remember just looking at jokes and just thinking, how does that work? You set up something and then you pull out the rug in some weird, elegant way you didn't see coming. I like that.
Yeah.
And so to that degree, I was interested in comedy, but I was not seeking out, like, I never went to stand-up comedy clubs or buying records or becoming super knowledgeable about what comedians were doing. But then I got to college and I got on the Harvard Lampoon, and it's this magazine that had been going since the 1870s or whatever, and the president was Conan O'Brien, and mm-hmm. he was very impressive to me. And I thought, this is what it's like when you meet somebody who really has some extra X factor. Okay. Little pieces are starting to come together in my mind about what I would like to do and be engaged in. And I was remarkably lucky. I, through long, labyrinthine circumstances not worth going into, I ended up as a writer at the Letterman Show and stayed there for 25 years.
Yeah, see, that I actually love when people come on and say, I didn't really grow up with comedy albums. I mean, our episode 300 was with somebody who said, could you pick one for me? And I said, sure, here's a Lily Tomlin album, let's give it a listen. And then she revealed to me about 10 minutes in, she's like, oh, I'd never heard a comedy album before this one you sent me. So I kind of like that. I always like hearing how people get into it for their own reasons. And I love that you saw jokes, could read jokes, and the math of it seemed to work for you, and you wanted to figure out the math of it. Seemingly.
Well, the downside of that is, and this comes up in the movie as well, if you're charmed by that initially, but then you're immersed in it too much for too long, I have what I call comedy damage. And I listen to comedy or see comedy and people are roaring with laughter around me, and I just go, yes, I see how the schematic diagram on that functions properly. There is a danger, and I think most comedy professionals have this to some degree, of just like you're too used to it now, and the quote unquote normal and conventional comedy, as well crafted and beautifully executed as it may be, it no longer has the capacity to truly surprise you. And that's a price I've had to pay over the decades. And maybe that's why I really went so hard onto this industrial musical stuff, because I thought I need new frontiers of comedy that I can't get anywhere else through normal channels anymore, because the normal stuff, I appreciate it. I like to do it. I like to see people laugh, but to actually knock my own head off now, I need something so esoteric or unexpected that I have to go find something else.
Well, after 300 episodes of this show, if somebody tells me one more time that they want to talk about George Carlin's Class Clown, which is my favorite album almost of all time, we've talked about it 7 times. I'm barring it from the show forever. So now I'm on the lookout for local albums. Like it's as close as the equivalent to what you're doing. I love local comics, even though most of the time what you're getting is 40 minutes of racist and homophobic stuff. I'm at least trying to see if I can find one that isn't that, you know.
38 minutes of that should be enough. I know a guy slightly who got in touch with me after seeing the movie, and he was fascinated by it, but he's like a country music DJ, and his project is collecting and cataloging all the sort of under the radar local bands across the country for decades who cut records and pressed 500 copies of them for their friends and to sell at the barbershop in town and all that, and were never known outside of their region. So I understand that impulse also. And there's a lot of chaff there, but there's got to be some great stuff sometimes too.
For sure. Yeah. That makes it worth it to me. I mean, I generally think that most comedy albums are not great, but I still like The Hunt a little bit.
Just if you think there's one more great one out there, I mean, that is a compelling feeling. I'm still collecting the records for my collection. I don't find new ones very often at all now. But I know that there are things out there that no one has ever seen because only 200 copies were pressed and no copies have ever crossed the path of a collector yet. And over the years, a couple of those will come my way, and most of those won't even be great, but there may still be something out there great. Like I remember the time dealer got in touch with me. Oh, I found a record that you might want. I was at a thrift shop in Nebraska because I was in town for a funeral and I had time to kill, and I pulled something out of the bin that I think you'll want. And it was some something I'd never heard of at the time, the Dominion Road Machinery Company 1975 sales meeting. I thought, well, I guess I got to pony up the $75. You got me over a barrel. I think I need to at least confirm that either it's good or bad, or if it's not good at all, I want to know about that too. And it was genius. It was just, oh my God, thank God that this surfaced, this album about road machinery features and sales programs, and it's all this weird klezmer Middle Eastern stuff. No credits on it. I still don't know to this day anybody who worked on it, but just, yep, once in a while, some crazy black swan or white swan or something will come out, and you'll realize again why you keep going.
I'm curious, are there, if you don't have to talk about it, but oh my God, that is the loudest truck. They won't hear it while you're talking. Is there anybody? This is so distracting. I apologize.
I love this. No, this is perfect.
This is the worst shit.
Have a show about comedy. Let's have sort of surreal interruptions occasionally.
I was curious about who anybody else you might have written with at the Lampoon. I've interviewed a few Lampoon people from around your era, so I'm curious who else you might have worked with or written with.
Oh, yeah. There was a pretty healthy crop in those years of people who went on to work in the business. Paul Sims, you mentioned, he worked at Letterman for a while alongside me. Bill Oakley went on to have a career at The Simpsons and other shows since then. David Cohen co-created Futurama.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people like that. Some people are in the film end of things. Some people are in TV. Some people did not go into the show business world and are doctors and lawyers, and God bless them because we need that too. But yeah, it was a pretty good batting average of people who said, I want to be in some form of comedy and show business, and scrambled up and got onto the rung of the ladder and kept going.
I want to, so normally we end our shows, well, I'm going to let you promote stuff as well, but before I do that, I always say, hey, why would you listen to this album? Well, it's easy for you. It's your album. But I'm just going to say, why seek this stuff out? You've already made the argument, but in a short, you know, in the briefest way possible, why seek out this incredibly strange thing?
To me, it felt like something that surely comedy writers must have made this up, but it was real, and it was this really potent blend for me of done sincerely but with great craft and verve and just catchy tunes, but about the least likely subject matter you can imagine. I just thought, I could not have imagined that this existed, and now that I know about it, I want all of it, and I want to find out about how it happened. And now you don't have to worry about that journey because that's all been done for you. But just at its core, if you just think, if there was one of the catchiest songs in the world and it was about bathroom fixtures or tractors or electric power generation or something, I think a lot of people who are interested in comedy who would listen to your show would say, that piques my interest. I want to find out about that.
It's to the point, honestly, where that era of Dave, if the second I would have seen any of these, I would have probably assumed, oh, Dave and his writers made all this crap up. There's no way this is real. I would, because to be fair, there were those, let's do scenes from entirely fake musicals, let's make up a boy band. So
that we were very good at, and some brilliant, really wildly convincing fake things like that got on the air. But for found item comedy, whether it was supermarket finds or mm-hmm. the newspaper headlines or record collection, Dave was very, very strict about, we cannot be monkeying with this material. If it's not 100% real, then it's disqualified. If it's done intentionally funny, then it's disqualified. he had the great attitude about that, about we are going to find what's real, and it's going to be hilarious, but we have to keep the standards up about it.
It rides this weird line, you know, of, let's appreciate this ironically, but also let's be as pure as we can. You know, let's make sure that what we find is legitimate. We want people to appreciate the fact that this exists. And that, so it is a weird line, because all of a sudden you still want to make sure that it's legitimate, because it's so much funnier.
Right. It had to be real. But then what nobody saw coming was that out of this segment of, let's just make snarky jokes about these weird, pathetic record albums, something would blossom that revealed an entire chunk of American history and a wildly elaborate subculture. And when the book came out, Dave gave us a very nice quote for the back, and then he became involved in the film. I interview him in the movie. Not too many people get to do that. And I think he was pleased and surprised and proud that a segment from his show had morphed into this enormous, almost little empire of discovering and celebrating a lost world of show business.
It's wonderful. I want you to tell people, well, obviously, where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find the movie, where they can find the book, where they can find the soundtrack, and where they'll be able to buy it on vinyl when it happens.
Oh yes, let's make sure people have the opportunity to get all this stuff, because I just, for decades now, I've just been, my mission has been to tell people, oh my God, wait till you see this, you won't believe this. So yes, the book is called Everything's Coming Up, Prophets. It's in its second printing now, available on Amazon, a beautifully produced book. Sport Murphy and I were thrilled with our publisher, Blast Books, that made sure every detail in Grace Note was spot on, just thrilled with that. The movie Bathtubs Over Broadway, directed by Deva Wisenant, who won an armload of awards and prizes for this thing, on Amazon and Netflix and iTunes. The soundtrack is also on iTunes and Amazon and Spotify, I guess, if that's a thing you do. And yeah, I'm on the social media. I'm not super active generally, but you can find me on like Pants Steve on Instagram and Twitter, and that should be enough for most reasonable people.
I think so. First of all, again, I want to thank you for the movie. I'm going to have to read the book. I haven't yet, but thank you for the movie. Thank you for...
I give all credit to Deva, who told a bigger, wilder, more beautiful story than I could have imagined, but I was certainly thrilled to be a part of it. And I did collaborate on some original songs that are in the movie and are on the soundtrack also, so I've got a little songwriting career now.
And those are delightful as well. I mean, there's some stuff in it that, like, just, I don't know. It opens up my little heart. And I really like that about it. I also want to emphasize something you said a minute ago that was really important. And I think some people who are maybe in a position like I am, who love comedy albums and like to expose people to them, it's your attitude of, I can't wait to show this, rather than how have you not heard of this, is so critical to making this stuff of interest to people. When you're passionate about something, I like to just emphasize that people do what you do and say, hey, I can't wait to tell you about this, not how do you not know about this, what's wrong with you? Sometimes that stuff happens.
In the case of industrial musicals, there was no way to say, how did you not know about this? Because it was a miracle that I found out about it, and I wasn't supposed to know about it. So nobody... is getting that attitude from me. It's just I lucked into finding this treasure trove, and I think you may believe in it in the way that I do if I show you the right way. So there it is.
Your passion really sells it. And the movie's lovely. I will pick up the book and obviously the soundtrack when it comes out on vinyl. Steve, thank you again for doing the show.
Oh, my pleasure. It really is fun for me to talk about all this. It's been a wildly beautiful part of my life.
People are going to love this episode. I know it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!